There are lights adorning houses in the plaza. We've had a few snow flurries, shopping centers are abuzz with activity, and you can now get peppermint mochas at cafes. The holidays mark the appearance of many familiar sights, sounds, and smells. And at holiday parties, the drinks that get served are fairly typical, a spiced cider or eggnog. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we're going to take you into the science and mystery behind molecular-based cocktails, but this time with a holiday twist. Later in the hour, we'll look at how a modest program to upgrade streetlights is changing the look, feel, and budgets of many local cities and towns. That's coming up right after this news. The holidays mean holiday parties, and holiday parties mean holiday cocktails. And while you might be expecting a spiced eggnog, hot toddy, or mulled wine, you might not be expecting a cocktail containing roasted butternut squash. This is Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. In July, we dipped our toes into molecular mixology. It's similar to molecular gastronomy, sophisticated and chemically creative ways of preparing food, but in this case with alcohol as the centerpiece. Today, we'll be revisiting molecular mixology, but in the context of creative holiday cocktails that will surprise and entertain your taste buds. Joining us from studios at UC Berkeley is Adam Rogers. He's the articles editor at Wired and the author of an upcoming book, Proof, The Science of Booze. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
And we're also joined in studio by Scott Tipton. He's a bartender at Manifesto. Scott, good morning.
Good morning.
And then we also have here Berto Santoro, he's the president of the KC chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. Welcome, Berto.
Good morning.
And so, Adam, I want to start with you here. What makes a molecular-based cocktail? How is it different from your typical run-of-the-mill cocktail?
Well, you know, I have the feeling that answer would probably differ from bartender to bartender. The notion of molecular gastronomy, as you said at the top, evolved from the idea of molecular gastronomy, this idea that you could take the techniques of a laboratory, or really more properly an industrial kitchen, like the kind of place that was preparing food that you would sell on store shelves or that you might see on an airplane, take those techniques and apply them to more haute cuisine, to higher value, more expensive food. And then the bartenders picked some of that up. So that can mean anything now, from the use of unusual ingredients that you might not expect to see behind a bar to the use of processes that you would be more familiar with in a university laboratory or an industrial lab, like rotary distillation and evaporation, or using chemicals to get interesting effects out of the drinks.
So who was doing this? Who started this kind of exploration of molecular mixology?
You know, I would say probably different bartenders came to different approaches at similar moments. There mm-hmm. was a bartender in Portland named Jeffrey Morgenthaler who started playing around with things like aging his own cocktails and using kind of bottling and canning that he had taught himself. There's a writer named Darcy O'Neill who worked a lot on taking some of the history of not just pre-prohibition but late 1800s pharmacies where alcoholic drinks were sometimes served as well, and rebuilding some of that history to use interesting chemicals like lactate or acid phosphate. And then, you know, one of my favorites actually is a place in New York called Booker and Dax, where a sort of mad scientist inventor named Dave Arnold plays with a lot of lab toys and industrial toys to try to, again, get these effects that you wouldn't see in another bar. And sometimes they're sort of transparent to the person sitting in front of the bar. They just know they've got a delicious drink. It's really the sorcery stays invisible down in the well.
Yeah, that was going to be one question I had, which is, were some of these people trained chemists? Were they like, I'll just go out and buy a centrifuge because, you know, that sounds like a great idea right now on my bartender salary?
You know, it's interesting. Like Arnold was a trained sculptor, but he got into the work because he got interested in molecular gastronomy. He was in New York and hooked up with one of the chefs who was playing with a lot of these techniques, named Wiley Dufresne. And I should say, too, a lot of the chefs and some of the bartenders, too, tend to eschew that title now. They won't describe themselves as molecular anythings anymore. They want to just be known as chefs or as good bartenders. But they're still using the techniques because they get a because they're fun and because they get an interesting drink out of it and because they get some value from there.
Yeah. Customers. Well, I was just before the show, I was talking with Scott and Berto and want to bring you guys into the conversation. Scott, is that something you feel like kind of antagonistic towards, like being a molecular bartender?
You know, we definitely love the classic, I think, idea of being a bartender, you know, and making drinks at the very heart of it all. When, you know, mixology comes in, I think sometimes people get the wrong idea about, you know, what it might entail, what it might mean to somebody or represent. But, I mean, it really is, you know, it's kind of a melding of ideas and of the kitchen and science with bartending and that classic look with kind of this new modern techniques as well and everything. So nothing's shunned necessarily. It's, you know, it's all open for interpretation and individuality.
But if you were to be introduced to someone and it's like, oh, what do? You would just say, I'm bartender at Manifesto. I'm like, you wouldn't go, I'm a molecular bartender.
Well, when Bert and I walked into the studio today, we actually said, hi, the mixologists are here. So
we actually talked about that on the way in. I think we should do that all the time. Who called for the mixologists?
Yeah. And Berto, when did you get into kind of a more scientific or kind of more technical?
I think all of this happened in the last 5 years, where Jeffrey Morgenthaler and David Arnold and Don Lee and all these guys were doing really cool cocktail stuff and really breaking it down. And it's like a second renaissance almost of the golden age of cocktails. And so I think I got into it about 4 years ago.
And you mentioned some names there. I'm not familiar with Don Lee. Are these
We were talking about everybody except Don Lee. No, he's a New York bartender. Mm-hmm. One of those innovative bartenders that are doing some molecular gastronomy and simulations of flavors and really, you know, out of the box type of stuff.
And so, Adam, I want to talk to you about some of the tools that are used in this. Can you give me an example of some of the technology that's being used that, you know, you wouldn't typically find at your stereotype idea of a bar?
Yeah, and I would say I'm not sure you probably still would find some of these, but some of the fun stuff, right?
Like, yeah.
Most of the time when you are if you're at a very basic bar, you'll get served your soda pop out of a gun, right? Where they're mixing the syrups and carbonated water below the bar, and there's a squirter that they can press buttons on with their thumbs, right? Mm-hmm. And it's easy and it's cheap. Now, higher end bars up from there won't serve from that. You can get some off flavors. It'll go flat. You don't have as much control over it, so you'll serve from little ponies, little bottles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you can start to make your own, right? So if you can start to make your own tonic. Instead of getting store-bought tonic water, you can start to go to your local herbalist and pick up cinchona bark and, you know, the sort of things that that were largely relegated to the world of homeopathic medicine and herbalism. Here in Berkeley, they're maybe more familiar than in other places. And you can start to do your own infusions, right? So you can begin to borrow from the coffee obsessives and get those presses that you can infuse coffee and squirt the coffee down through filters, you know, into your cup. You can use one of those to start to make syrups for tonic water.
And
then you can get your own carbonated water line, right? So you can carbonate to your own specs, have the bubbles the exact right size because you think that affects flavor. And that's just the beginning, right? You can go from there all the way up through using chemicals that when they combine make a sort of gel so that you can – it's called spherification. You can make little – anything from small like caviar size little balls to larger, let's say the kind of marble that you'd use as a shooter instead of inside the circle and make the drink into that or make as they do there's a place in D.C. called Mini Bar that does this. Like the instead of an olive inside a martini, you would have like a gelled olive-flavored kind of ball that you had made yourself, and that would be at the base of the martini.
What is that ball made of? How do you even begin to do this? Is it like a tapioca kind of base?
It's similar, and I'm going to try to remember what the chemicals are. The ingredient, like the basic ingredient, would be like a brine. Right, you'd start with an olive brine flavor, and you might have sort of a pepper mix that you've done yourself to simulate the pimento. And then it's calcium chloride, I think, and then maybe it's an agar? I'm not remembering. You can actually buy these kits for home use now. You can get home spherification. Who doesn't want to do spherification at home, right?
I know. Well, it sounds so, like, crazy. You know, yeah, that's flavored, right. Flavored balls that you make up yourself.
Or, that's right. I mean, it's sort of, you know, think of it as a highly sophisticated Jell-O shot, I suppose, would be one way to imagine it. Mm-hmm. And I will say I've had one iteration of the martini with that, and I'm pretty sure this was not because of the recipe, but because of the execution, was probably the worst martini I've ever had. Some classics maybe you shouldn't mess with. But you can actually see a lot of fun stuff with that spherification. And then that extends all the way out to – I mentioned rotary distillation. There's a machine called a RotoVap that was primarily used to separate solvents from each other in a lab. So things like acetone, right? But what you can do is, because it lowers the pressure, you can do kind of small controlled distillations. So instead of needing a giant still that you use high levels of heat and pressure, you can control those things with lower levels of heat, controlling the pressure differently. And you can actually make your own gin, let's say. You can start with a neutral spirit, high test vodka, basically, and control your own botanicals, like I mentioned, that cinchona bark earlier, or lemon peel, and have a house-made gin.
Huh. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Our guests are Adam Rogers, the articles editor at Wired, and author of an upcoming book called Proof, The Science of Booze. And we're also joined by Scott Tipton. He's a bartender at Manifesto Bar here in Kansas City. And Berto Santoro, he's the president of the KC chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. We're discussing molecular mixology and special cocktails for the holidays. Later in the hour, we're going to be taking a look at the impact of LED lights and what they're having in our towns throughout the metro. And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite holiday drink? Share your favorite recipe here by calling and joining the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Adam, I have a question, which is, and it kind of sounds a little basic on the outside, but like, where does flavor come from? Particularly in alcohol. Oh,
man, so the best thing about that question is that it seems like a simple question, but it's the kind of stuff that honestly has won people Nobel Prizes to figure out even just tiny pieces of it. But a very basic answer is that most of what we consider flavor is actually smell, not taste, right? So you probably know that the tongue perceives what are now considered to be five basic tastes, right? So that's sweet, sour, bitter, umami, which is that sort of meaty flavor, and salty. And there may be others as well. That's still under study. Everything else that you perceive when you take a drink or take a bite of food is actually your nose doing the work, because it's much more complicated. Those molecules are bigger and stranger and more interesting. And when it comes to drinks, even the sort of what we would consider a base spirit, let's say a whiskey or a gin, some of those molecules aren't characterized yet. If you do a chemical analysis on, let's say, a good single malt scotch, you'll find molecules that you don't know what they are that seem to have an aroma, or you'll be able to identify aromas that don't seem to be attached to a particular molecule. And people are still doing that work. You can imagine that both scientists are interested because it says something about how our senses work. And also in industry, those folks want to know how their products taste and smell because they want to be able to replicate it. They want to be able to do it again and again. That's something that actually the large beer makers are really good at, and the small winemakers who are often making very good products are actually not so good at replication, right? That's why you can have a vintage year sometimes and a year that maybe wasn't quite so vintage another. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all that stuff has to get synthesized in your brain. And your brain is doing that with also synthesizing it with the experience that you're having. So the bars that your guests in the studio run are kind of theater, right? And the best kind of theater. They're not just selling a great drink. They're also providing a place to have that drink, to have that experience. You know, a wine that you pour yourself at home can taste very different than that very same bottle brought to you by a experienced sommelier who's seasoning the decanter and testing it for you and doing the kind of presentation show that they'll do.
That doesn't say anything about the wine. Have people done studies into this about, like, you know, serving a $10 bottle of wine, you know, at a fine restaurant and then, you know, the same one at home? How do we know that?
Well, very much so. That one famous study, in fact, showed that people's enjoyment of a bottle of wine was directly related to how much they were told that bottle cost. And I don't mean to put that down. That's actually okay, right? Part of what you're paying for is the experience, is the theater of it. And I think that's important. That's part of the experience of eating any kind of food or drinking any drink. One of my favorite studies actually took people, gave them a glass of white wine and asked them to describe it. So it didn't matter if they were particularly experienced. They were just supposed to come up with a lot of words that they would reliably use to describe a white wine. And as you would expect, they said a lot of the things that people say about white wines, that it was fruity and maybe kind of oaky and a little bit buttery and the sort of stuff that you would say given a glass of white wine at a friend's house or at a restaurant. And then they took those glasses of wine away and then in the back room added to those wines flavorless and odorless color. The same pigments you get from grape skins. They're called anthocyanins, essentially turning the white wine into red wine. And then they brought those wines back out and said, okay, now describe these. And the people inevitably used words that you would use to describe red wines. Sort of oaky, tobacco-y, the dried fruit flavors, things like that. Like their whole experience of the wine changed because they had been given a different color, which you would think would have no effect on flavor, right? But in fact, it changed their entire perception of the wine.
So it's not just as simple as – so even in molecular mixology, you can be trying to infuse all these flavors but to try to control them precisely, but it can be all the experience.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I think that's really important. And I think – so somebody like Dave Arnold at Booker & Dax in New York would say that he's trying to have more tools to create different flavors and different experiences that you can actually perceive. And you can go into that bar and never ask how they do it. And you'll have a drink that you've never had before or that is a variation, let's say, on a drink but very different, a drink that tastes exactly like one you've had but is a totally different color. And that's just fun. That's interesting. And he can control it more precisely, he would say, because of the techniques he's using.
Well, we have a number of drinks and mixes here in front of us here from Scott and Berto, and definitely want to get to that. And I'm also joined in the studio by our Casey Kearns intern, Esther Honig. Good morning, Esther.
Good morning.
And she's here to help give some reviews of these drinks, and also mostly because I have the tolerance of a small child, and it's good to have her here as well. Scott and Berto, if you guys could begin mixing the drinks, and then I'll probably ask you questions as you're doing it. So, Scott, what are you going to be making for us right now?
I thought we'd start off with, we mentioned at the outset of the show, the roasted butternut squash cocktail. Mm-hmm. So we serve this at Manifesto, and it's called the Winter in Buenos Aires. So basically, kind of in the holiday theme and also kind of that melding of the kitchen with the bar, we roast butternut squash in the oven, for about 45 minutes, take it out and then puree it. And then we're putting this in a cocktail with a honey cinnamon syrup that we make in-house, which all this is actually easy to replicate at home. There's definitely, I think as Adam mentioned, some of the mystery in all this at a bar when you walk into. But it really is transferable, to the house when you want to make those holiday cocktails. So a honey cinnamon syrup, a roasted butternut squash, a little bit of fresh lemon juice, and the fresh is the key word there. Just buying the pasteurized store brand won't necessarily get you to the same spot. Mm-hmm. And then for the booze, the most important part, we're using a cachaça.
I'm not familiar with it.
It's basically a Brazilian style of rum that comes from fresh pressed sugar cane, as opposed to molasses, which you might find in a lot of your nice rums. And then we're going to give it a good shake.
And so you're pouring ice into
a shaking tin, yeah.
Don't let me down here, Scott. Nice technique. Sounds like you work at Manifesto.
It's not my first shake.
Yeah, no, not your first rodeo.
Not your first rodeo.
So then we're going to double strain this to kind of get, some of the pulpiness of that butternut squash out into this nice coupe, which is, kind of the old school glass that, a little bit better than a martini glass you see a lot of times. But if you look for a coupe, maybe online or at a place like Williams Sonoma, really holds the cocktail in a better shape, I think.
And I've often wondered this about, and Adam, feel free to chime in here, and I'm sorry you can't enjoy these drinks with us here. And
you're not that sorry. This sucks.
but the shape of a glass, does that also affect how the aromas and taste, or is that just some kind of like sales gimmick? Yes and no?
Yes to both questions. You can certainly buy a wide variety of glasses. Now, so the coupe that you guys were describing has that sort of curved shape. They're lovely, right, as opposed to the kind of upside-down cone of the classic martini glass, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a notion that you're concentrating some of those aromas into the headspace, which is the let's say, the area where you're still in the glass but not into the liquid yet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you'd want to do with a wine or with a cocktail. Typically, you're not as worried about that with cocktails. Ethanol is a solvent, and it is really good at carrying those aromas and flavors. So it tends to be more intense already. But you can imagine something like a brandy snifter versus a coupe, right? A brandy snifter being kind of a big goldfish bowl because you want to concentrate those aromas. But nobody's actually sure, like, does a different shaped brandy snifter do it better for a different brandy? The kind of, you know, there are some companies that you can buy a different glass for any kind of wine varietal and cocktails and even water. And those shapes basically come from the manufacturers. They aren't kind of scientifically tested as much as experientially tested. The only really reliable study I ever saw for that said that people tended to drink beer more quickly from glasses with curved sides as opposed to straight sides. So if you're trying to nurse your glass, you want a straighter side, straighter sided glass.
Interesting. Esther now has the drink in her hand. And Esther, what does it smell like?
I'm sensing a very strong sense of nutmeg. It's kind of like a pumpkin pie sort of smell going on.
Why don't you give it a shot?
Yeah, we grated some fresh nutmeg on top just to give you that sense.
Oh, wow. It's much more citrusy than I would have expected.
Okay. And now I'm going to give it a shot here. Yeah.
Kind of like the mix between something like a glass of orange juice and a pumpkin pie, I want to say.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing.
It is. And I'm just going to have more to figure out what I want to say.
It's nice to like that cap of foam on top. It really makes it more of like a texturized experience.
Yeah, you know, you think of like a really good butternut squash soup, and then, you know, and then you don't necessarily think of that in a cocktail necessarily, in a cold drink.
Yeah,
you know,
and that was going to be one thing. It surprised me how, like, I saw you pour ice in it, but for whatever reason, I was like, oh, I'm going to be drinking butternuts.
Right.
Butternut squash soup.
But it's the consistency isn't, you know, thick. It's got a good, you know, nice thinness to it that, you know, tastes good and it's easy to refreshing at the same time.
And Berto, what have you been working on over here?
First of all, I'd like to touch on what we were just talking about the shape of the glass affecting the taste of the cocktail. So I think that from my standpoint, the shape of the glass, people's perceptions are changed by the shape of the glass. So making that cocktail right there and serving it, say, out of a styrofoam cup here would taste different than serving it out of a coupe like we're doing. Mm-hmm. It's like drinking wine out of a plastic cup. I think that it might not necessarily actually taste different, but your perception is – you
just
perceive
as Adam,
that totally different. Yeah.
As Adam was alluding to earlier.
Absolutely.
That whole kind of experience it will influence your flavor. Scott?
I think we all drink and eat with our eyes. I mean, it's kind of the classic – adage, you know,
for sure. People and also what you're telling them that they're supposed to taste. So when somebody comes up to my bar and asks me for a special drink, which they do all the time, I ask them some questions, I make them a cocktail, and then they ask me what's in it, and I never tell them what's in it until after they've had a sip, because they're going to taste whatever their brain wants to perceive they're tasting. And so I think that's an important thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. So it then gets back to that theater of the bar.
Oh, for
sure. Which is probably why they're all so darkly lit and, you know, and there's mood lighting and they're even uniforms, you know, involved and costumes. So what have you been working on, Berta?
So I've got a little holiday cocktail here with Sorrel. It's a little liqueur that just came out in the market here in Missouri, and it's from Brooklyn, Red Hook, Brooklyn. It's kind of hibiscus, cassia bark, which is essentially cinnamon. Nutmeg, cloves, allspice berries, and it definitely packs a flavorful punch. Low in alcohol content, 15%, so more like a really high-proofed wine. Mm-hmm. But the flavor kind of takes over. It's huge, huge flavors. With some Heyman's Old Tom Gin to booze this up a little bit.
Because 15% is just not nearly
surely
enough.
Surely at 10:28 in the morning here, we're going to need to get this done.
Yeah. Far too stiff.
Some honey
right
to
now.
Sweeten it up and some lemon to balance this whole thing out here.
All right, great.
That sounds fantastic.
I'm so sorry, Adam.
I love this chase that everyone has. It's just so
what do you think
almost
of this,
like a dance.
Chaser, Scott?
It's a 10:28 in the morning shake. This is kind of cruel punishment for Adam, though. Yeah. That is the main theme of the show.
Drinking is really – it's really not an audio medium drink,
yeah.
I've noticed. It's
Well, I never –
You know that
– Go on. Sorry, Ed.
Well, I was just going to say the shake that you were talking about, I have read some measurements of that. It really is amazing how fast a shaken drink will get cold compared to stirring it or just letting something sit on ice. That shaking, it really does reduce the temperature at a very high speed.
And how does that affect flavor?
Well, you're going to get a different sensation in the mouth, first of all, mm-hmm. right? Ethanol has will spark a little bit of a heat perception as you taste it, as well as kind of a little bit of bitter and a little bit of sweet at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the cold will damp that down, which means that you'll want to kind of drink it faster a little bit. Also, when something's hotter, it's going to move those aromatics in a sort of different speed to the top of your nose where you're perceiving them. So when it's colder, it'll reduce some flavors and enhance others.
Mm.
So it's I think maybe more like as a speed thing, like regulating how fast you want to drink it. But also, you know, there were entire categories of drinks that were served hot as well. So they were making distinctions with, like, here's sort of flips that we're going to mix with egg and heat with a red hot poker that we stick into it and stir it around versus the ice cold stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of have fewer of those categories. Now it's more expected that you're going to get a cold drink.
And Berto, Esther's about to drink the drink. And what's it called again?
We'll call that Christmas in Red Hook.
Christmas in Red Hook. And Esther?
It definitely tastes like Christmas.
Totally, right?
I have to say, almost like a Christmas tree. I kind of get that image in my head when I take a sip
goodness.
Of it.
Oh, my goodness. I must try this. It's one of my...
If it was Thanksgiving, you would say it tastes like Thanksgiving in your mouth. It's definitely those holiday flavors that mm-hmm. we all think of this time of year, for sure.
It has a kind of a fruitier smell.
It's a piney smell, too.
Oh, my goodness. I'm like underneath a tree, you know.
Passed out.
Not yet, but pretty soon.
Passed out. I was going to say playing with, you know, my toy train around the tree, but.
You know the truth.
Yeah, as a full-grown man. That is delightful. That is delightful. And so, Scott, I hear you have another drink for us here, and this one involves, looks like a little bit like homemade whipped cream machine. What is that called in your hand?
We brought this in last time, actually. This is an ISI, which you can get, you know, pretty much anywhere now. I think even probably Target sells
ISI?
Them.
ISI?
Yeah.
And you pronounce it ISI?
Some people might say EC. ISI. I don't even know what it stands for, to be honest with you.
You know what? I don't, but I bet Adam does.
Adam?
Oh, right on the spot. I don't. Let me get out my phone.
You got this. You got this, Adam.
All right. Well, you check on your phone there. Go ahead, Scott.
So, like, a gentleman that Adam mentioned at the beginning of the show kind of came up with this technique, at least, you know, introduced me to it, which was Jeffrey Morgenthaler in Portland, Oregon. I've had the pleasure of sitting at his bar a few times. And so in this ISI machine, we're basically going to flash infuse a cocktail with wood, with the smokiness that you would usually have to age for a couple months in an oak barrel, something like that, in a matter of basically 24 hours.
Hmm.
So we're putting the booze into the machine, basically a Manhattan, two parts rye whiskey and one part sweet vermouth, and then putting wood chips in, and then putting a nitrous cartridge in here. So this has been charging for about 24 hours.
So the nitrogen gas is creating an incredible amount of pressure in the container you're holding.
Right.
And that pressure is infusing the wood chips and the flavors and smells into the alcohol.
Exactly, yeah, extracting the flavors from the wood chips, which maybe Adam could, you know, probably delve more into the science of why that happens with nitrous, you know. And we don't want to use a CO2 cartridge to carbonate it. We just want to use the nitrogen to kind of, you know, pull those flavors out of the wood into the spirits.
Okay.
Let me jump in here real quick. I was actually having a really interesting conversation about this the other day and heard a really cool scientific term for this called nitrous cavitation. Brandon and I were talking about this. And so what it is exactly essentially doing in there is these things that you're infusing are surrounded by oxygen bubbles. And now you're forcing in nitrous oxide, which are exchanging the oxygen for nitrous oxide. And then when you release that pressure, back again. And so that's where all that flavor is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually very similar to when divers worry about getting the bends. Right, the nitrogen kind of stays in solution. But, you know, what's interesting about this, too, is that the idea of trying to simulate the flavors of aging, which is something that distillers would love to do, because right now the only way to reliably get the flavor of something aged in a wood barrel is to let it sit in a wood barrel for a few years, which you can imagine is pretty expensive and kind of the purview of the larger distillers, let's say. But they would love to find a way to do it faster. One of the ways to do that is to use a smaller barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Changes the surface to area ratio, but typically if you age for a shorter time, you get what are called the extractive flavors. You get the flavors of the wood that are let's say green and resiny and kind of piney, and you know, the idea, like, if you chewed on a piece of wood that you would taste or that you smell if you smell fresh wood at a lumber store, let's say. But what you don't get are other chemical processes that only happen with time, oxidation and esterification, the formation of new molecules that are the things that we might associate with when you taste a drink and say, oh, it tastes really smooth or it tastes really mature or rich. And nobody's really sure how to get that into, let's say, a whiskey that's only been sitting for a few months instead of a few years. Mm-hmm. But you can actually get some interesting flavors just by messing, instead of with time, with other variables like with pressure. Put something under pressure and some of the other chemical reactions happen more quickly than they would if you just let it sit by itself on an open in an open glass on a bar. So that's what's going on inside that nitrogen injector.
Great. Thanks, Adam. And does it get really hot under all that pressure? Adam?
No, I mean, there's not, you know, that can happen if you start to think about the extreme pressures, let's say, at the bottom of a diamond mine or something.
Yeah.
But really, you're not, you know, you're not putting so much pressure on it mechanically that you're going to see a temperature change, I think, especially not just for 24 hours. I guess it might get a little warmer than it would ordinarily. Mm-hmm. Typically, with gases and liquids, pressure and temperature are related, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's the chemical equation that you're talking about, but not so much here. I think what you're really just going to get is an acceleration of some of the chemical reactions that you would otherwise have to wait for a long time for.
Great. And Esther, what do you smell?
You know, I smell the wood. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, is, you know, really to, this might not be as necessarily Esther's speed of a cocktail, you know, not having like a lot of those citrus or fruit drinks, not pass any judgments at all, but you know, the idea is basically,
so every woman loves a fruity drink.
No, absolutely not. But we talked about it before the show, and I know, you know, that those might not be the flavor profiles, but the idea is that we're getting those wood flavors, those oak flavors out of that oak in a matter of hours as opposed to months or weeks.
Mm-hmm. And what do you taste?
It's definitely a lot more robust and a lot stronger than the other drinks. I the wood brandy, it tastes a lot like, is that what the whiskey? Mm-hmm.
It's a rye whiskey.
Oh, rye whiskey,
but,
okay.
I can see where the sweetness of the, you know, the sweet vermouth might come in there and create some brandy flavors for you.
Oh, wow, it's incredibly smooth and like velvety on the tongue. And yeah, it feels a little bit more like a whiskey and it has like a very kind of woody oak kind of taste to it.
Sure.
It's delicious.
Yeah, like woody winter by the fire with a cigar, you know, a gentleman, mm-hmm. and you could see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would drink it with you, Esther.
Yeah. Again, no judgments passed.
Is it your speed? Do you like it?
I might lean more towards the squash, the roasted squash drink. Mm, sure. That might be more my speed.
And Berto, what's up next? You mentioned
First of
something
all,
with
I
heat.
Think I need to taste this barrel.
Yeah, here. Please.
And a really interesting fact about that stuff is barrel aging, like Adam was touching on, is a super expensive endeavor. You're talking about throwing some white whiskey in there for potentially years of an investment with no return. And so to immediately be able to get pretty much the same effect, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a fantastic cocktail.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
And definitely a lot of wood. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever barrel of or force infused a barrel aged cocktail before. That's really, really tasty. Mm.
And so you have something with heat here
involving. I'm gonna do a hot drink. So this is an old cocktail called a Tom and Jerry, and this is from Jerry Thomas, or at least he was given credit for making this cocktail. And now it goes back first in published in about 1847 in the Jerry Thomas book, but they've seen some newspaper articles where this goes back even further, but. For this case, we'll give Jerry Thomas credit. How about that? So Jerry Thomas batter, what I did is I whipped up some egg whites with some potassium bitartrate, which is the crystals that form in wine casks. Mm-hmm. And so this is basically a stabilizer for the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a separate bowl, I did some egg yolks with some sugar, vanilla extract, and some dark rum. I used some Gosling's Black Seal rum in this one. And so we're going to give a couple ounces of this guy.
It's very thick coming
very
out
thick,
of it.
Very thick, huge.
It looks like pancake batter almost.
Oh, I was whipping it up this morning, nice, mm-hmm. by hand.
Oh, my goodness.
So then we're going to
I'm really
some
jealous of this.
Eat your
heart. Bartenders almost never do a Tom and Jerry because it's a huge pain. You almost never see it on a menu. I'm really jealous.
Adam, I heard you were going to be here and we were going to talk science, so I thought I'd make this a cool, complicated, start throwing out words like potassium bitartrate just to impress you a little bit.
I'm impressed. That's a winner.
So we're going to throw some brandy. I'm using some Pierre Ferrand cognac in this guy. Some hot whole milk. And I crushed up some cloves earlier and a little mortar and pestle. And I'm going to shave some cinnamon and nutmeg on top here.
You know, we still have a couple of drinks from this category. You're probably going to have eggnog this year, right? But you can imagine that there were dozens of these kind of drinks with different flavors built in, but using the egg as a base to have a different consistency. And some of them served hot, some of them served cold, some of them with more, some with different spices, some with different spirits. It would have been really interesting to go into a bar like Jerry Thomas's, let's say, and have the, you know, a list of 12 different eggnogs that you could have tried instead of just what we're used to, you know, bought from the store and mixed kind of slapdash with whatever brandy happens to be on the shelf.
Yeah, I definitely get the smell of it is very much like eggnog, and which is delicious. And let me give it a shot here.
It's essentially what it is. It's an eggnog made with cognac instead of, say, a whiskey or a hardcore rum.
Oh, my goodness.
Tasty stuff.
Oh, my goodness. It's rich and deep.
Definitely rich.
Yeah. Very rich. But, like, I don't know. I just felt like I kind of, like, dove down and then, like, was exploring an ocean bottom. Wow. One more time.
You hear that description? That's ocean nice. Bottom. Scott, are you taking notes here?
Definitely, yeah.
Well, yeah. Everyone go out and get two of these.
I could be there in about 4 hours, I think, if I really booked to Oakland International. I could probably get there.
Wow.
Just put one out for me.
It's so much more frothier than like a typical eggnog. It's not something that's going to weigh you down or like fill you up. It's really
Yeah.
Nice.
There's that richness, but there's also this fluffiness with all the air particles into the froth. You know, it doesn't feel like, oh, I drank an eggnog and I'll be carrying that around till December of next year. So.
Definitely my favorite one by far. It doesn't feel like you just drink a whole bunch of eggs. It's just kind of like a nicer experience.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, we have just about 3 minutes left here, a little bit less than that. So can you tell us what you're making now?
Sure. I mean, the other idea I think we had to kind of cap this off and come back full circle with the Manhattan that we aged was just starting a new batch of bitters. And so bitters, you know, is kind of one of your old school, basically the salt and pepper of cocktails. You're taking different barks or roots or herbs and infusing those essentially with a high proof alcohol that extracts those flavors and then, you know, putting them into a cocktail to kind of just give another layer of flavor. So our idea was taking, and we've kind of mentioned some of these words before you might have heard today with like talking about the cassia chips using cinnamon and then for a bittering agent using wild cherry bark. So these are real barks that we're just going to take and put into a mason jar basically, start off with. And then add a high proof alcohol, like a, you know, you want to start with at least like a 90 proof spirit, but you know, the higher the proof, the better to really extract those flavors. And then we thought we would take from the KCUR break room some of the roastery coffee and start a coffee bitters the local, you know, roastery coffee, which is awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm so sorry. We got to cut it short there just because we're just running out of time and we have to get to the next segment. But we'll drink this and put this up our review later today. That's all the time we have. I want to thank Adam Rogers, the articles editor at Wired and author of the upcoming book, Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Tipton, bartender at Manifesto. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And Berto Santoro. He's the president of the Kansas City chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. Thank you, Berto.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be looking into the bright future of LED streetlights. Central Standard returns in just a moment.